We'll go back again to the case of the Yifat Torah, the beautiful woman that the soldier finds in captivity. One of the commentaries has a completely different approach to the whole situation. And let me tell you some of the things that bother him in order to change that approach, in order to come to that different conclusion. The first problem he finds in the way the Torah introduces the situation. I mean, what the Torah is trying to tell you is that if you find this beautiful woman in captivity, that you shouldn't rape her, right? That's the point. You shouldn't rape her, but bring her, wait for a month, and then decide whether you like to keep her or not. If this is the point of the Torah, why is it necessary to start the command in the following way? Ki teitzei lamilchama al oyvecha, if you go out to war against your enemies, unetano Hashem elokecha biyadecha, and God will deliver them into your hands, and you will take people in captivity, you'll take prisoners. The Torah should have skipped this whole beginning, and the Torah just told you the following. Im ba-milchama ra'ita ba-shivya eishet ifat Torah, if during war you see in captivity a beautiful woman, why is it necessary to go through the details when you go out to war against your enemies? I mean, what's the point? Of course, I mean, you went to war against your enemies. Unetano Hashem elokecha biyadecha, and God will deliver them into your hands. I mean, if it's trying to tell you that some wars are won by men and some wars God is behind it, obviously we'll have to reject that. Right? It's the type of a war that God delivers your enemies into your hands. I mean, we believe that all victories are delivered by God. So why is it necessary to describe the victory as being given to you by God? So this is the first problem. The introduction to the commandment seems redundant, seems unnecessary. The second problem is a language problem. Why is it necessary to say at the end of verse number 10 here, the first verse in this parsha, Veshavita Shivyo, and you will imprison its prisoner, a prisoner. I mean, you imprison people. Do you hear the difficulty in the double expression of prisoner? Veshavita, this is the verb, Shivyo, it's prisoner. Why is that necessary? Obviously, this is a hint to something. Then he goes on, this commentary, it's the Or HaChaim, to say the following. From last week's portion, we see certain requirements of the soldiers who went to war in biblical days, who went to war against the enemies, people who attack Israel and want to destroy it. So we have in last week's portion that not everybody used to go out to war. For instance, in chapter 20, verse number 8, Chaf Chet, V'yasfu ha-shotrim ledaber la'am, and the people in charge would speak to the soldiers, ve'amru, and they would say, Mi ha'ish ha'yorei, if any one of you is afraid, is fearful of the enemy, verach ha'levav, his heart is sensitive, meaning you can't go to war, you're afraid, go back home, don't fight. So the commentary of Rashi quotes here a rabbinical tradition according to Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, according to Rabbi Yossi. What does it mean, a person who is afraid? What is he afraid of? Rabbi Yossi HaGlili Omer, Hayore me'averot shebiyado. If anyone has committed a sin for which he didn't do tshuva, he didn't rectify the sin, don't take a chance. Don't go to war. Because it might be that if something happens to your group, it's going to be your fault. So you better go home and work on your soul. It's not for you to go to war. You're not ready yet to go to war. Now, what can we conclude from that? That a person who went to war in those days was a righteous man, we might say. And anyone who has committed a sin and hasn't rectified it yet, he wouldn't have gone to war. So those are tzaddikim, very righteous men. So when it says here, in the continuation, this is chapter 20, this is chapter 21. So it's the continuation of that army, right? We are describing what that army of very righteous men is doing. So this righteous man, Kiteitzela milchama alovecha, when they see the enemies of the Jewish people fighting against the Jews, it's part of their righteousness to go out and fight and defend the Jewish people. So when there is a victory, the tzaddik, what does he see when the Jews are victorious? As opposed to the average Jew. The average human being may have a difficult... It may be difficult for him to see the hand of God in everything that happens. But the tzaddik has no such problem. So when it says here, and God will deliver them into your hands, it's not just describing a reality. It's describing a perception. It's the type of people who only see the hand of God in everything that happens. In other words, again, who are we describing? Those tzaddikim that went out to war. Okay? But now, the problem is magnified, he says. If we are talking about extraordinary people, tzaddikim, they go out to war, how would you imagine they would react, those people without one sin? If they are aware of one sin that they committed, they wouldn't go to war. So this perfect tzaddikim go out to war and they see a beautiful woman. Can we suspect them that the first thought that comes to our minds, boy, I wish I could rape her? I mean, does that fit with the type of an army we have just described up to this point? Obviously not. Obviously not. I mean, it just doesn't fit that the tzaddik, he can't control. And even if the thought just crossed his mind without an act of will. So are we going to say that he doesn't have the self-control to overcome the desire? I mean, obviously, there is something incongruous here. Says the Ora Chaim that it is extraordinary, such a thing, that a tzaddik should have such a thought. But if the thought does occur, it's because of a very specific reason. And let me tell you the reason that the Ora Chaim gives for such an extraordinary situation. You know that according to the Kabbalists, we think, for instance, that my soul and my body are one, right? Obviously, no one else can share my soul. That, the Kabbalists say, is an erroneous idea. No. A soul is something separate from ourselves. We are given a soul, but I am not my soul. As a matter of fact, we say every single morning in our prayers, God, the soul that you gave us is a pure soul. So how do we describe the relationship between the soul and ourselves? Not I, the soul, but the soul that you gave us. What does that imply? That the soul is something separate from our essence, from our own self. We are given a soul. According to the Kabbalists, sometimes we have a repetition of the soul-giving process. In other words, more than one person can share the same soul. As a matter of fact, it can be for a good reason. Like, for instance, the soul of Moshe Rabbeinu, or part of his soul, whatever that means, can enter again the body of Rabbi Akiva. Right? And that is a statement which is made. that Rabbi Akiva shared the soul with Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Of course, this is something good that happened. In other words, Rabbi Akiva shared certain spiritual characteristics with Moshe Rabbeinu. But sometimes it can be something negative, like a soul that lacked something. There is a certain lack, there is a certain flaw in the soul. So that soul will come back to this world and enter someone's body in order that that person should rectify the flaw of that particular soul. Did you ever hear this concept? The concept of what's called Gilgul Neshamot? That's the name that's given in the Kabbalah for this idea. Gilgul. What is it? How is it? Reincarnation. The reincarnation of souls. In other words, people sharing souls with someone else that can be living today or in the past. Yeah. Oh yeah, sure. The problem of one soul being in different places, you don't have, right? You can have many people sharing one soul.
At the same time?
Oh yes, no problem. Now, ideally, of course, right, a soul shouldn't have to come back in this world in order to be rectified. But somehow, sins, flaws, causes this distortion that the soul has to go to someone else in order to rectify it. So this is a basic distortion in the system. Meaning, in a perfect world, there shouldn't be a need for this Gilgul Neshamot, which is caused by sins. Now,
can a soul be fractionalized? Can a soul be fractionalized? In other words, can you take a soul and have a part of the soul go to one?
Well, of course, there's a sure. Then it's souls. That's like we said, parts of a soul, right? There is such a concept, like fractions of a soul. Now, this distortion of the system can even cause something extraordinary, which is a Jewish soul theoretically entering a non-Jewish body. In other words, Gentiles who have been entered by a Jewish soul. And then what this person has a natural drive to do is to rectify the soul by becoming Jewish, by becoming a convert. As a matter of fact, in the writings of the Arizal, you have the following statement. Every Gentile who has converted with his whole heart to Judaism is a Jewish soul that had existed, which had entered a Gentile body, he says. And he brings proof from different statements in the Talmud. I once mentioned one of his proofs, which is really unusual. There is a statement in the Midrash, in the rabbinical literature, which says that a Gentile who converts, a Ger Tzedek, a Gentile who converts with his whole heart, will be asked in the Day of Judgment, why did you wait so long? In other words, if you were 25 years old, why not when you were 24? Why not when you were 23? Why did you wait so long? On the surface, it's a very difficult statement. Why? Because this assumes that a Gentile has an obligation to become Jewish, right? Doesn't the fact that in the Day of Judgment he's going to be asked, why did you wait so long, imply that he has an obligation of becoming Jewish? Now, we don't find any obligation for a Gentile to become Jewish, just the opposite. We are supposed to dissuade him from becoming Jewish. True? So what does that show? That once he does convert, that shows retroactively that what? That he had it in him all along. He had a Jewish soul all along. So we ask him, didn't your Jewish soul push you all along to become Jewish? So why did you wait? Why did your body struggle against your soul? Right? So this is one of the hints that he finds in our Talmudic literature for this concept, for this idea. Now, let's go on to the next step. Okay. So the first concept then is the concept of Gilgul Neshamot, the reincarnation. The second idea that I told you is that this reincarnation even goes as far as entering the Jewish soul, the neshama, or parts of the neshama entering a Gentile body, and that conversion is perfect conversion, which means conversion without an ulterior motive, according to this Kabbalistic idea, is just the result of the Jewish soul trying to rectify itself, to come back home. Okay? Now we're going to go on to the next concept. And this next concept is the concept of zivug. The concept of zivug pairs says the following. You know that according to our tradition, the original Adam, the Adam that was created by God, was a combination of a male and a female. Did you ever hear this idea? It's an idea mentioned in the Talmud, which means the original Adam was male and female together. It was a bisexual entity. And when it says that God created Eve, he just separated the male and female parts. This is a statement in the Talmud. Now, this has the following consequence. What was the purpose of that separation of the male and female parts? It says that was in order that the male and the female should sense the basic unity of the male and the female part, and they should be able to perceive and experience that unity. That's why they have to be separated, which means as long as they weren't separated, the male and female part, they weren't aware, they didn't experience the unity. In order to experience something, you have to also experience its opposite. In other words, if God had to give the people the capacity for happiness, he had to create the capacity or the possibility of a state of non-happiness. Otherwise, the state of happiness would never be perceived, would never be experienced. In order for light to be experienced, we should know what it is. There has to be a possibility of a state of non-light, darkness. Otherwise, light would have no meaning to us. Meaning, in order for any state to have a meaning to us, God had to give us its opposite in order for that particular state to be experienced. Therefore, God, in order for men and women to develop that sense of unity, he had to separate them in order that they should experience separation, for them to eventually re-experience the unification, and that is marriage. Okay? So marriage, in its ideal sense, is a return to the original state of man, of male and female. In other words, in the ideal marriage, we say that the souls found each other, the half souls meet each other again, and they recreate the original oneness of that particular soul. Did you ever hear this idea of zivug? Now, not everybody reaches that state of perfection. Right? Not everybody finds exactly the perfect mate, like the Talmud talks about zivug rishon vezivug sheni, which means the perfect mate and the almost perfect mate. You can come close to that perfection, right? But there is such a concept of an absolute perfection in marriage. Yeah.
Adam was androgynous.
Originally, yeah.
And you're saying that he couldn't experience the alternative of this wholeness. In other words,
he couldn't experience the oneness. Right? Yeah.
That's difficult to understand, because if he was, on what level was he unable to experience that wholeness? I mean, was this a method in which God was setting him up for the sensual aspect of it? Because here you're already reducing, you're making a reduction here. If you have a hole, you're dividing it, okay? So you're dividing it, you still have a hole, but the hole that's being given is one that's a physical hole. It's a physical, setting it up toward an alternative vehicle in which now man is going to become more aware of his physicality, whereas before, he wasn't aware of his physicality, but he had the ability to imagine he had the ability to imagine what his completeness was on both the male and female level.
I mean, we don't know much about the state, but we have certain descriptions in the Torah. But first of all, it's not a physical separation, it's also a spiritual separation, which means that according to our tradition, the soul starts seeking its partner. It's not only physically that he's seeking its partner, the soul seeks its partner, and the physical attraction is just a physical reflection of a higher need. Meaning, the need should ideally start from the soul. In other words, when you meet your perfect mate, your souls draw towards each other. Physically, you'll just feel a reflection of that higher reality.
The perfect mate was implanted within.
Right, and then separated, right? No, even on a spiritual basis, on a soul basis, meaning the soul becomes separated, whatever that means. Meaning certain parts of the soul, if we can describe it that way, go to the male, right? And there are, and then the other half goes to the... The act of separation led to the sin, of course.
The recognition that the physicality was more prominent than the spirituality.
Yes, okay, in other words, without the act of separation, there wouldn't have been a sin, but... We must accept that the purpose of creation was the sense of otherness and the eventual unification. I mean, it's not only, don't forget that there is something much deeper here, which is the relationship between men and God, which again has to be a reenactment of the relationship between male and female. I don't want to go into the details, but this is the really the deeper level of the purpose of the whole thing.
The relationship of man and God was more prevalent. He was a totally spiritual being, and he didn't need the relationship between man and God. You're suggesting that he needed a greater relationship with himself, which was the separation.
Exactly. And that would lead to a higher relationship with God also. In other words, first it has to start in this lower level, the awareness of self, the awareness of separation, which eventually will lead to the unity. Meaning, man has to become aware of himself in order to unite with God too. And that, so the whole process of the relationship between male and female is a prerequisite to the relationship between man and God. We see it, for instance, from the Song of Songs, that we describe the relationship between man and God, and the metaphor is what? The relationship between male and female. Now, yeah.
Yes, I can see the soul trying to find its counterpart, just as the soul... in a non-Jewish body, wanting its...
Okay, all right. You're already going to the next step, right?
Okay, but
yeah.
the beginning part, what about a non-Jewish... What about a... what about a non-Jewish...
Soul going to...
A Jewish body?
All right, we won't talk about it, okay? Because I just want to stick to the what's necessary for the Ora Chaim, to understand the Ora Chaim. Okay, so then we brought in then a new concept, the concept of the Zivuk, the perfect partner, right? And remember the first step that we went through, which is the Gilgul, the reincarnation of a Jewish soul into a Gentile body. Now, putting everything together, whatever we said up to this point, let's try to reevaluate what's going on here in the beginning of the portion here. The tzaddik, the extremely righteous man who has... The self-confidence of saying, yes, I can go to war because I have nothing to rectify. I have no sin to rectify, because if I have a sin to rectify, I just won't go to war. So it's a tzaddik. It's a very righteous man. And this very righteous man, with his constant awareness of God, all of a sudden feels a very intense attraction to this woman here. To this Gentile woman, what can we conclude, right?
That she was really a Jewish soul, and that that's the one that was meant for him. That's the match.
All right. There is no question about it. When such an experience happens to a tzaddik, it's not the same experience that would be happening to you and me. Maybe you are a tzaddik. I don't know, but it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing. An experience of that sort for him has a very deep spiritual meaning. It's the meaning of it is that he has, that his zivug, his second half, is right there. The second half, that's soul, is imprisoned in a Gentile body. True? It's an imprisonment. It's in jail in a Gentile body. It's not where it's supposed to be. But it wants to be released. Now, remember that we paid attention to the last two words in verse number 10. And you will capture Shivyo, an imprisoned person. You imprison an imprisoned person. And he asked the Rachaim, what does it mean? You don't imprison an imprisoned person. You imprison a free person. And you make him a prisoner. What does it mean that you have just imprisoned an imprisoned person? You have just imprisoned a Shivyo, someone who has been imprisoned in his own body. So according to him, we are just describing this extraordinary experience of two half-souls meeting each other and sensing that this is it. So, says the Torah, still, don't trust yourself. Go through a test. Don't trust yourself. Don't rely just on this immediate feeling, because you can never tell. After all, you are only a human being. Give yourself a chance to reconsider it in a much cooler and rational way. First of all, make sure that this is not just a physical attraction. Now, how do you make sure that it's not just a physical attraction? How do you make sure that these are the souls just being attracted to each other? Right. Remove all those things that may create just the appearance of that spiritual experience. Sometimes the physical circumstances may give you an incorrect appearance of a spiritual experience. So make sure that you remove it. Okay, so these are the instructions. And for 30 days you see her in her ugliness. If after 30 days, while you are completely cool and rational, you still decide that she's the right woman, go right ahead and marry her. You have found your mate. This is the way the Or HaChaim understands it. And there is another very interesting observation. The word desire. You know, by the way, in the language of the Torah, there are no synonyms. You may have different words that seem to be to mean the same thing, but there are no synonyms. Here we find an apparent use of a synonym for the word desire. If you take a look in verse number 11, which is the word used for desire? Yud Aleph. In verse 11, which is the word which is used for desire? Choshakta, cheshek. Desire, and you desired her. Vechashakta bo. Okay, so this is the word for desire. Chashakta. Toar, Yefat Toar, that she looks beautiful. Toar is the way she looks. In verse number 14, at the end of the month, there is another word for desire. Can anybody find it in verse number 14? Yudalet. Chafatzta, chafetz. Now, it's interesting. Why do we change the word for desire? Why is it chashakta in the beginning and chafatzta at the end? Now, what? Well, yeah, right. Yeah, what?
They also translated the second time as delight.
Again?
They say delight.
Delight? In verse number 14, imlo chafatzta ba, and if you don't...
have no delight in her.
Delight in her. It's interesting.
Instead of desire.
So probably they meant also to differentiate between these two ideas. The word cheshek is just something which is physical. Like, for instance, you see something that you enjoy, chocolate cake. If you love chocolate cake, the appropriate word is cheshek. You have cheshek for the chocolate cake. What about if you decide that something is good for you, and then your desire follows your decision of what's good for you, then it's not cheshek anymore. Cheshek is always when something starts with your desire. You follow me? In other words, a desire which is the outcome of a rational decision is not cheshek anymore. Then it's chafetz. Chafetz chaim. Mi ha'ish e chafetz chaim. who is the man who really wants life, right? So you would say, if you love life, do what you feel like doing, right? No, that's a person who is cheshek chaim. A choshek chaim would be a person who just gives in to everything he desires. A chofetz chaim, a person whose desire follows a rational decision, he is a chofetz chaim. Do you hear the difference between cheshek and chofetz? This is what's happening over here. In the beginning, you always have to suspect that your desire is what kind of a desire? A cheshek desire. Can't take her now. Make sure that this desire is a chefetz desire, not a cheshek desire. You have to test yourself. Even if you're a great, great tzaddik, don't rely on yourself. Give yourself a test. If at the end you pass, take her. She is your right partner, your proper partner. This is the approach of the Or HaChaim to the whole situation here. Yeah.
Yes, when it also says that she's a godly or beautiful woman, could be her spiritual qualities, or is that her physical beauty?
Exactly, exactly. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says, Rashi brings it down right here, Eisha tifat toar, what about if she's ugly? The same law applies to someone who is ugly. So that again is a proof. If she's ugly, why is she described as a beautiful being? We are describing her spiritual qualities. Otherwise, they wouldn't be attractive to you. Okay?
It seems like a very limited case.
Exactly. According to the Or HaChaim, you remember yesterday we were speaking about why does the Torah allow such a thing? Right? After all, why should we give in to someone's desires? So we said different approaches. According to the Or HaChaim, this is an extremely limited case. This is only under those extraordinary circumstances that a great tzaddik goes through such an experience. That's exactly what it is. It's a case from which we can't draw any general conclusions because it's so specific.
Doesn't the zivug require that both the carriers of the souls come lead towards meeting each other? It seems that here all that's happening is that the tzaddik is having his spiritual realization and she's just completely involuntary. I mean, she's taken captive. She's not making any expression that she wants to reach this meeting of souls at all.
You're right. You're right. But according to the Or HaChaim, remember that somehow, under the perfect circumstances, the souls will tend to draw to each other like magnets. So therefore, it's not a coincidence that the woman happens to be there next to the battlefield. Okay? So according to the Or HaChaim, nothing in such a situation is a coincidence. Okay? Yeah.
This is an interesting resolution to what you said yesterday regarding that. Compromising with the Yetzirah, because if it's done here in the context of the Tzaddik compromising with the Yetzirah, it's one thing because many before she say that when you start injecting tumah within your system, it just leads you to wanting to have more tumah, and you're able to rationalize it, and then before you know it, the point at which you were, you're even farther ahead. So this particular type of person, when he's taking it into a system, is able to keep it in its proper perspective.
Right, right. In other words, the whole rule that we spoke about a few days ago, that sometimes you have the right to compromise with evil, according to the approach of Or HaChaim, does not apply at all. You're not really compromising with evil, just the opposite. You are elevating the physical attraction and using it for the elevation of both souls, for the unification of both souls. So according to Or HaChaim, the whole rule that we wanted to build from this particular case, and that many commentaries do build from this, we have to reject that. Okay, this is why I think I told you from the beginning that there are two approaches concerning the case of the Yifat Tovar. There's the regular approach and this the very special approach of the Or HaChaim.
So presumably the Or HaChaim would also disagree with Rashi that the outcome of this bond in the end will be that they hate each other and that the children are Ben-Sar.
Okay, I don't want to go into these details because a whole commentary has been written concerning this particular problem according to the Or HaChaim. There is someone who wrote a whole commentary on that which will complicate matters. I don't want to go into it.
One point, you say the difference in the two types of war, the wars of Chiyuv and the wars of Rishus that we may be talking about here is an answer to that? say in the one case we'll come to hate, we'll be in the war of Kiev where everybody has to go, where we'll have people that don't have the good vetoes that might come to this situation. The Archaim is a war of issues where only the righteous will choose to go.
Okay, right, right. This is what will come out. In other words, this prerequisite that you have to be a great tzaddik to come go out to war is like, that's what the rabbis say, b'milchemet harishut, which means it's not a type of a war that you are absolutely obligated to fight, like for instance, the war against Amalek or the war against the seven nations in Israel that wanted to destroy the Jewish people. We are talking about other types of war for other reasons, that in those wars we have this law that you have to be a tzaddik, according to Rabbi Yossi Aglili, to go out to war. Exactly, yeah.
Yes, Rashi comments that you will eventually hate her, but he's talking about if the woman was married and then you married her. This is what I think.
All right, because you know that the halakha says, for instance, you know, we accept, according to the Jewish law, is there marriage by Gentiles? Is there a concept of marriage by Gentiles? Now, do we, according to the Jewish law, recognize marriage by Gentiles? Definitely yes, of course yes. Why? How do we know that? Because one of the seven laws of Noah we spoke about to those of you who are here this morning is what? Adultery. Relations with someone else's wife. However, in this particular case, right, a Gentile woman who converts to Judaism, we ignore their marriage. Right? That's what it says. Even if she's married to a Gentile. In this case, you can ignore it. You can consider her unattached. That's what it says here. Eshet. Even if she's an Eshetish. Even if she has a Gentile marriage, it doesn't apply. Again, how do we understand that? Because this higher reality supersedes her Gentile marriage. In other words, this higher reality shows that her Gentile marriage is not a real marriage. Why? Because her soul doesn't belong to that marriage. She is another partner, and she has just found it. Therefore, you can ignore the original one. And by the way, that's the law. Even today, if a Gentile woman, even if she's married, converts to Judaism, she's considered single. Right? You know, it's her Gentile marriage, once she's Jewish, is ignored. It's a very unusual law.
She's not married anymore?
She is not married anymore. Once she becomes Jewish, she automatically, right, becomes Jewish, and therefore she seeks a Jewish soul. So her marriage to a Gentile soul is non-existent from now on.
What if he converts to Judaism?
Then they have to remarry. Right? They have to remarry. Okay? Okay, let's... Yeah. I'm sorry.
Aren't there some problems created by that, the fact that if they don't have a divorce from their husband prior to...
You mean what kind of problems? You mean practical problems?
Yeah.
So of course practically, like we find the following concept. You know that according to the Jewish law, once a Gentile becomes Jewish, even the Gentile's relationship with his own parents are actually broken. Now, it's from a spiritual point of view, we don't see his parents as his real parents. Right? However, the law is he still has to honor them. Why? That it shouldn't come out that a Jew, a Gentile who becomes Jewish, is less respectful to his parents than a Gentile who did not become Jewish. This is the rationale that the Talmud gives. In other words, we can't act as Jews in any lesser manner than we would have acted as a decent Gentile. Do you hear this? Therefore, anything which would seem immoral would be prohibited from doing. We would be prohibited from doing. In other words, if a Gentile who is married does become Jewish, we would definitely obligate this Jew now to give the Gentile a civil divorce in order that it shouldn't look like we as Jews act in a lesser moral manner than a Gentile himself. You understand what I'm saying? Which means, according to the essential law, it wouldn't be necessary. but it becomes necessary in order not to create a what's called a chilul Hashem, like a desecration of the reputation of the Jewish people. Okay? This is the idea behind it. Yeah, sure. Yeah?
What about the reverse? What about the instead of the parents, the children that they may have already had?
What happens to the children? Wait a minute, if a person converts, what happens to the children?
Yes, and they're still children.
They are the person's children, but they are Gentile until they convert to Judaism. In other words, if a person converts, he has to convert his children with him in order for them to become Jewish.
There's a lot of practical problems in dealing with this. It's not in logistics, I guess, where really working this out.
Well, of course, yes. Yes.
I have a daughter who's Laurits who is not Jewish. If she were to convert, then she is no longer my daughter. Is that correct?
In a certain sense, it's interesting. The Talmud says that if a person, a Gentile, has children while he's a Gentile, and they both convert, right? We're talking about a Gentile who has children while he's a Gentile, and they both convert. He has fulfilled his obligation of having children. Even if the children originally were Gentile and now they became Jewish, which means that a certain degree of the relationship does remain. I'm just proving to you that a certain... Because if the relationship would be completely cut off, then why would we consider in the Talmud that the man has fulfilled his obligation of creating human beings, having children? So you see that a certain degree of the relationship does remain, even if the children were Gentile and the parents were Gentile, and now they convert. So it means that the child is a child, but it's not like a full Jewish father-child relationship. Okay? It's a very complicated matter, this situation. Okay, is any other problems with this idea of Zivug? Now, let me just, since we don't have much time, let me just add... one little piece of information here. With this concept that there is such a thing as a Jewish soul in a Gentile body, we find a situation in the Bible of a marriage between a Jew and a Gentile woman. And afterwards, the Gentile woman converts to Judaism, right? And then we see them retroactively as being like a marriage, even though they were only married when they were Gentile. Who am I referring to? Huh? Who? Abraham? Well, you mean Abraham and Sarah, you mean that we don't know, because once he's accepted as being the chosen person, maybe Sarah is accepted at the same time. I wouldn't say. I don't mean in the Torah, in the five books of Moses. It's in the Bible, but it's not in the five books of Moses.
Ruth.
This is the situation with Ruth. It's something extremely unusual. This man, right, or the two brothers, really, go to Moab. There are no Jewish girls around, so they marry Gentile girls. There are no Jewish girls around. Of course, they are punished for it. They die. Both brothers die. But one of the wives, right, follows her mother-in-law, who's still alive, to Israel, and she converts. Okay? And then there is a whole process there, which is again a process mentioned in our portion of the week, this week, which is the process of the levirate marriage. We won't go into the details. When we get to it, we'll talk about it. You know the law of the levirate marriage. If a couple dies without children, there is a whole process how to go about it in order to maintain, we'll see the meaning of it later on, the name of the continuity of the man in this world. So a relative of the man has to marry the woman. In the Torah itself it says the brother of the man has to marry the woman. But this is only when there was a real marriage. Was there a real legal marriage between this Jew and Ruth? It wasn't legal because she was Gentile. So why is it that in the Bible we see it as a reality? The marriage between Ruth and the Jewish man is a reality. obviously, we are talking about not a physically legal marriage, but a real marriage in the sense of their souls. And this is why Ruth becomes like the symbol of the converted woman. You know, we derive all the laws of conversion, you know, from whom? From this Ruth. What she did, we have to do. So again, we find this concept of a Jewish soul which is imprisoned in this Gentile body and finally finds release. Okay, we'll stop here.